from Nixie, but a real woman. When she drew closer, he realized that she was not human. Her pale, seafoam green eyes were far larger than those of a human, her cheeks narrower, and her cheekbones sharper. Her thin mouth was set above a pointed chin. Long, ash-blonde hair floated in the water around her head, from which he could see the protruding tips of pointed ears. The entirety of her skin sparkled from the tiny translucent scales that covered it down to her waist, where the scales grew larger and darker over the length of a long, sinuous fishtail. She was one of the fabled merfolk, and in her hands was a sword, the Sword of Eirie. Rezkin reached out and stroked a strand of the mesmerizing woman's hair. She blinked at him curiously and then stroked his own. She was fascinating, but she was not the woman from his dreams. He grasped the sword. The water abruptly wrapped tightly around him, and his entire world became a rush of bubbles and rough currents. His ears throbbed and then popped as he ascended, and he gasped as his head breached the surface. Rezkin's companions shouted and reached for him, pulling him onto the platform. He lay there for a moment, staring at the shadows dancing among stalactites on the ceiling. After taking a deep breath, he pulled himself to his feet and then looked down at the sword. So much trouble he had endured to gain this worthless blade. It was not worthless to Privath, though, and that was what mattered. His ears popped again, and he realized that buzzing sound was his companions talking to him. "What?" he said. Mage Threl said, "You were down there forever! You are not even wearing your mask! How did you not drown?"
Farson said, "Perhaps he did, and his body refuses to accept it."
Rezkin frowned at his former trainer and then said, "We have the sword." He glanced back at the water almost longingly. He gained his feet and turned toward the walking path that lit as he approached. Farson's voice held a hint of laughter as he said,
"You lost your crown."
Rezkin brushed his hand across his head and realized that Farson was right. He did not care for the crown anyway. He was halfway across the walkway when Mage Threl gasped. Rezkin turned to see what had elicited such a reaction. He followed her gaze to a glinting object in the water. A feminine hand with slender fingers covered in tiny, sparkling scales held his crown above the water. He took the crown with one hand and held her hand with the other. She grasped his hand in return as he peered past the surface into her green gaze. Then she slipped into the depths and was gone. As Rezkin left the cave, he felt a loss, as if a part of him had been left behind. He glanced at his hand and found that some glittery flecks remained. It was a small token, but it was one he realized he wanted far more than the crown. He also realized that he longed for Kyle. Chapter 17 Isseria bristled as she approached the Echelon's tent. The battle had been delayed until they could reach the staging ground, and after having traveled north for 2 days, she was supposed to be in the midst of preparing for it. She was instead needlessly summoned to speak with the Echelon while the woman broke her fast in comfort. Isseria did not wait for an invitation to enter. She had been summoned, after all. She was not going to give this woman the power to make her wait. Isseria stalked through the opulent travel accommodations to the small table that held an assortment of preserves, breads, and cream. Dishari's smile was affable, while her tone held only contempt.
"Would you care to join me? These are some of the finest preserves the Cerulean has to offer. This one is from Forel, but perhaps you prefer a taste of home. I have an Ashayan mint fig. I'm not entirely sure what a fig is, but I do enjoy the taste."
"What do you want?" Isseria said. Dishari motioned to a chair.
"Please, sit down. I do not care to strain my neck looking up at you. No, your neck should feel great as you watch me go into battle."
Dishari laughed.
"I would never watch such a barbaric sport. No, I shall enjoy the company of Gemsbrick while you are dallying in the field, and shall be ready to celebrate our success upon your return." "You wish for my return?" "Of course. I do want to prevail over Orina, after all. I have no concerns that you will fare better than my Iphigen. He is a seasoned commander and is familiar with the style of Orina's champion, Capano.
Then what do you want? Said Isaria. Dishari placed her butter knife on her plate and said,
Very well. Do business. I wanted to give you a chance to withdraw the challenge. There is no need to risk your life when we know that you have no intention of staying to rule as Echelon. You cannot retain the position from afar. It will be pointless. I will withdraw my challenge for Echelon if you withdraw your claim for Lord Malcius.
She tipped her goblet back and said,
Well, you know I cannot do that. It would appear weak. My adversaries watch closely. Many covet my position. After today, you will no longer have that problem, said Isaria. You fancy yourself a wolf, but we both know you are a mere pup. Without the weight of the torque and support of your master, you and your house would have no standing in this queendom.
Isaria said,
He is not my master. He is my king and yours as well. He chose me because I can fight for him, not so that he may fight for me. If you have nothing more to say, I must return to my preparations. I go to win a battle today.
Dishari pursed her lips, so Isaria stood and then stalked out of the tent, heading toward the staging ground. When she arrived, she was surprised to see that her force had grown to nearly double what it had been at dawn. Several dozen men ceased their chatter and stood at attention. As one, they saluted her, not the formal bow given a Matrianera, but a one-armed, fisted salute to a soldier. Isaria nodded and said,
Thank you for volunteering for the battle challenge for Third Echelon. I am honored by your gift of service. It is time to solidify our plan of engagement, as you were.
The men relaxed and returned to their preparations as Isaria looked for Balin. She found him going over plans with Malcius. For Malcius's sake, she spoke in Ashian.
The Echelon is worried. She tried to get me to withdraw my challenge.
As she should be, said Balin. The Echelon likes to think her consort a military genius. He is a brutal warrior and a good leader, but he has always depended on his second to devise the plan.
How does that help us? She said.
Balin grinned.
I am his second.
Isaria smiled.
That is good news. I am unfamiliar with the terrain. My opponent, she thumbed over her shoulder, my men, pretty much all of it. I'm depending on your experience and guidance.
That will make you a good general, said Balin.
Isaria nodded.
Reskin says it's important to recognize your follower's strengths and capitalize on them. He says that I should not believe that I can or should do everything better than everyone else.
This Reskin sounds like a wise man. Is he your trainer?
Yes, he is my king. And yours.
I had heard rumors, but I did not believe them all. I did not realize you were so close to your king.
Isaria's face flushed.
We are not close in the intimate sense, if that is what you were implying.
I should say not, said Malcius. After seeing her frown, he said, What? I'm trying to defend your honor, as you asked. She blinked in surprise.
Thank you, Lord Malcius.
Malcius crossed his arms and nodded once, then looked at Balin, who seemed utterly confused. Balin shook his head and then withdrew a map. He explained how he thought Iphigen would conduct his battle and then covered his own plan. Since Dishari was defending her claim to the land, she had the privilege of choosing the battle site. She and Iphigen would each be defending their own small hill. The Fourth Echelon's forces would be attacking from the north, and a small tributary bounded the hills to the south. Isaria pointed to the river bend on the western flank of her hill. Iphigen's hill was not adjacent to the river.
Can they use this to flank us? She said.
Balin shook his head.
It would be difficult. The river flows in the other direction.
Could we use it to flank them?
He rubbed his chin.
It would be a good plan, but we do not have enough men.
Arena knows that, Isaria mused. She knows that my force is smaller than Iphigen's. She would not expect us to split the few we have.
Because it would be suicide, said Malcius.
Maybe not, she said. Is this map accurate?
Very much so, said Balin.
Then look. Our hill is steeper on the northeastern side. This means that Arena will not be able to attack us from due north. It will force her to move slightly to the west. But there is a rise here. Her troops will be closer to the river, but they will not be able to see our unit in the water until it is too late.
Balin nodded.
Would you say it is true? But we still need more men.
Ysseria placed her hands on her hips and said,
How can we get them?
Perhaps a demonstration. Some of the men are not convinced that you can fight.
She huffed.
I made it to the second round of the fifth tier at the King's Tournament.
You would probably have made it to the third if Rezkin had not defeated you, said Malsius.
She glanced at him, uncertain if he were chiding her. He appeared sincere, so she said,
Thank you.
He furrowed his brow.
For what?
Balin said,
It is true then. You are the female swordmaster who is at the King's Tournament?
Ysseria paused and then lifted her chin.
Yes, I am the swordmaster.
I see. This is why the Echelon chose archery instead of the sword,
Malsius said.
What kind of demonstration did you have in mind?
Never mind, said Ysseria. I know what we'll do.
Malsius and many of the warriors who had committed themselves to her cause followed Ysseria as she stalked to the center of the encampment. Others stopped what they were doing to investigate the commotion. She turned and faced her men, bowed, then turned to face the gathering crowd of onlookers. She bowed again and drew her father's sword, holding it in front of her, the tip toward the overcast sky. Then she began to move. Her form was graceful, but her motions strange to Malsius. After the first few passes, some of the men began to clap. Others joined them, and after a minute, Malsius was surrounded by an intense cadence of long and short claps. Every so often, the men would root as one, a barking sound that complemented the patterned claps. Malsius leaned over to Balin and said,
What is she doing? I've never seen a sword form like that.
It is not a sword form. It is a sort of ritual, a dance, but with meaning. It is only performed by the royal guard upon a queen's death or crowning, or when the army goes to war. It is meant to provoke dedication and instill strength. I do not know how she knows the dance. But she must be a swordmaster if she is capable of performing it without killing herself.
Ysseria tossed the sword into the sky, allowing it to flip end over end before catching it. Then she swept it behind her back and did the same. Each time she caught the sword, she performed some acrobatic that might have even impressed Rezkin. Malsius became more anxious with each turn, and his sense of relief when it was finally finished was surprising. To Balin, he said,
Her father was a royal guard. He taught her the sword.
Ysseria ended with a flourish, and the crowd erupted in cheers. Men and a few women came to speak with her, and Ysseria urged every one of them to join her force. Some of them accepted immediately, while others said they required time for consideration. After she had spoken with the majority, she rejoined Malsius and Balin.
Balin shook his head. It is a risky move. But we might have enough to pull it off.
Malsius looked at Ysseria and said,
May I speak with you privately?
They walked a short distance to where they could still be seen but not heard. He said,
You do not have to do this. Let me be your champion. I will go to battle in your stead.
She scoffed.
What are you talking about?
Look around you, Ysseria. This is a real battle. People will die. You need not risk your life on my account. I will fight the battle for my own freedom as your champion.
You cannot be my champion, she said. I have claimed you. You could fight as my champion in any challenge except the matter of the claim. For this matter, you would need to accept the claim, and we would be required to consummate the bond before witnesses.
I thought that was only for marriages. I thought that anyone could fight as your champion.
Anyone can, unless I have claimed him. Then we must complete the bond. It does not matter if it is for husband or consort, although the requirements for husband are more intense.
Malsius's thoughts were thrown into chaos as his heart raced. Pallas had lost his life to save Ysseria. He could not just let her walk into a battle and get killed. Why had he never considered that before? He needed to keep her safe. He said,
Would it be so terrible? It is certainly better than dying.
She slapped him. Malsius raised a hand to his stinging cheek. The shock of it woke him from his panic.
What?
You are a horrible person, Malsius Jabai.
But what I do with my body might be acceptable here in Lundaresh, but anywhere else, I would be a ruined woman.
Do you hate me so much that you would sentence me to a long life of loneliness?
No, I...
And you have no faith in my abilities as a warrior. I have trained hard for this, and I am capable. I risk my life to keep you free, and this is how you repay me?
Isaria stalked away, and Malcius was left wondering what in the world had just happened. Balin strode over as he watched Isaria storm off toward the staging ground. He said,
I know not what you said to her, but I think you are lucky to have gotten away with a slap. She looks furious enough to win the battle on her own.
Malcius groaned and followed her through the crowd. Some of the men laughed at his misfortune as he passed, while others offered their condolences. He was so preoccupied by the attention that he nearly ran into a hulking man who stepped in front of him. The man grabbed hold of his shirt as he lost his footing, preventing him from further embarrassing himself by falling onto his rear. The man said,
I am Mage Dolina. I will fight at your side.
Malcius looked up at the dark-skinned man, obviously of Pruari descent. He was one of the largest men Malcius had ever seen, and his voice rumbled like a war drum. Malcius grasped the man's hand.
I am Malcius of House Dubai. I thank you, but I must ask why. You have only seen me make a fool of myself.
Dolinar grinned, his broad smile lightening the mood. He slapped Malcius's shoulder and said,
It looks like you'll need the help.
He is not wrong,
Balin said with a smirk. Mage Dolinar turned and pushed Malcius toward the staging ground. He waved a hand toward the men and said,
We have all been in similar situations with our matrias.
Well, perhaps not yours exactly. Most of our matrias depend on our strength as champions for physical challenges. Your matria is a she-wolf. She readily bears her claws and teeth, but I think she would not be satisfied with a docile man.
She is not my matria, said Malcius.
No, but she will be once she defeats the Echelon's champion. You are a lucky man.
You seem confident that we will prevail.
I am a truth-seeker.
You can see the future?
Dolinar laughed.
No, that is not a talent I bear. I see things as they truly are. Knight Isaria is worthy of her title. Her confidence is genuine. The Echelon fears her.
So, you chose the side you think will win?
I choose the side that I desire to win. I do not care for the Echelon. She is devious, always scheming. It hurts my eyes to see so much deception, but it is most common in women of power in our queendom. The only way to gain power here is to take it, and the support of their peers is crucial. The good are eventually corrupted of necessity. That one, though, she shows her true self. It is most refreshing.
Malcius followed Dolinar's gaze. Isaria was standing at the war table speaking with Balin's sons. A ray of light shined through a crack in the clouds to glint off the torque around her neck. Malcius said,
Perhaps she can afford to be true because she is backed by one more devious than the rest.
You speak of your king.
And yours,
Malcius said, meeting the man's dark gaze.
It is not wise to speak of royalty with such disdain.
He would not deny it. I think he prides himself in the effort, but he seems to feel no pride, or anything for that matter.
You know him well.
Malcius glanced at Isaria.
I once called him friend.
But no longer.
You ask many questions, Malcius replied.
Dolinar shrugged.
It is my talent. I seek to understand the things I see. I do not believe you reject your king.
Malcius kicked a rock.
No, I do not reject him as my king. As a friend, it is complicated. I have blamed him for all our troubles, and I depend on him to solve them.
He glanced at Dolinar's knowing gaze and shook his head.
I guess, inside I know he is not responsible, yet I trust he will make amends regardless.
He growled in frustration.
I cannot let go of the anger.
Dolinar nodded.
When I was young, my father was killed in a challenge. I blamed our Matria Nera for a long time, even though she was not responsible for his death. It was easier to blame someone I cared about, someone with whom I felt safe, than the true enemy that frightened me.
Dolinar briefly crossed his wrists and said,
If you will excuse me, Malcius Jabai, I must confer with my comrades.
As Dolinar walked away, Balin said,
He is a wise man. You would do well to heed his words.
Isaria shaded her eyes with her hand. The clouds had dissipated by late morning, and the sun shone bright over the battlefield. Echelon Orino's troops were scattered around the base of the hill to the north, the largest group toward the west, as she had predicted. She did not look to the south, where Balin led the second unit down the river.
"Are you sure we can trust them?" said Malcius. "We have no choice," she replied. "Balin seems a decent fellow, but these people are conniving. He admitted that he is Iphigen's second. What better way to sabotage us?"
"What does it matter?" she said. "If he betrays us, then we lose. If he were not with us, we would have no troops, and we would still lose. If he is with us, at least we have a chance at winning."
"You should have let me lead the second unit.
He is more familiar with the terrain and the men."
She saw his frustration in his dark glare and clenched jaw. He said, "Where do you want me then, Matria?" She scowled at him.
"Go wherever you want."
He lifted his chin and said,
"Then I shall stand beside you."
The first horn blared, and the troops on both sides began to move into position. Isaria found that her men were all accustomed to the challenge of battle and required little encouragement or direction. She spied Iphigen on the far hill. He was pacing back and forth in front of his men, presumably delivering some inspiring speech. Isaria had no such speech. These men did not know her, nor did they care much for her cause. Most of them probably fought because they relished the battle. She walked along the front line, then turned and raised her voice.
"You do not know me, so to ask you to fight for me would be less than inspiring. But you do know Echelon de Shari. If we win, you need no longer concern yourself with her."
Her gaze roved over their faces. None cheered, probably out of fear of what might happen to them should they lose, but a fire lit within their hungry gazes. She grinned.
"We fight to secure our survival, and we fight to destroy our common enemy. We fight as one, as a pack. We fight as wolves."
This time the men rooted. It was the same cadence they had chanted during the dance, and it was inspiring. Their chant grew louder, and even those on the adjacent fields turned to stare. The second horn blared, and the battle began. The front line of Orina's troops pushed forward, ascending Isaria's hill. They hid behind large shields attached to logs on wheels, each pushed by a half dozen men up the slope. Iphigen's archers cast the first volley of arrows at the men climbing his hill, but Isaria waited. After two volleys on the adjacent hill, the frontline infantry rushed from behind the shields to attack Iphigen's forces. Isaria returned her attention to her own battle. When Arena's front line was nearly to the top, she raised a signal flag. Her men abruptly shifted into a grid pattern with large gaps between the files. Dolinar cast his spell, and dozens of boulders from the other side of the hill began rolling forward between the columns. Isaria gave the signal to the archers, who aimed high so that their arrows would drop behind the shields to strike the men pushing the logs. The arrows struck, just as the boulders tumbled down the front slope, crashing into the shields. With no one to hold them, the logs plummeted backward, rolling over and dragging the men behind them. Some of the men were able to escape the shields before they were crushed, and Isaria's infantry met them with force. Just as Isaria was beginning to feel confident, a fierce wind began swirling atop the hill, capturing shields and shoving her troops into one another. Dozens of small fireballs, none large enough to kill but certainly large enough to cause damage, were cast toward the crest, where they were whipped up by the wind. The fires spread, and the fireballs struck at random. During the commotion, Orina's forces gained ground. They began to swarm the hill. Isaria could hear the pounding of hooves, but she could not find their source. Suddenly, the illusion dropped as if a curtain were drawn back, and a small cavalry unit plowed through their lines. She called to one of her mages, a life mage who was already in the midst of casting a spell. The horses suddenly reared and began thrashing against non-existent restraints. As the confused horses ran amok, her archers and pikemen took down their riders. After striking down an infantryman who had been unlucky enough to top the hill, she turned to Malcius. She grabbed him by the collar and pulled him away from the man with whom he was engaged. After running her sword through the man's ribs, she turned to him. She held the signal flare out for him and said, "Lead the charge!"
"What? Me? Now?"
"Yes, now! Go!"
He grabbed the flare, and Isaria watched his back as he cut his way to the front line. He activated the purple orb that propelled itself into the sky, setting phase two of their plan into motion. Isaria's troops descended the hill, leaving a gap in the line to the west. She was depending on Dishari's duplicity, certain the echelon had been feeding her opponent information. Arena would know that Isaria had little experience and would expect her to make novice mistakes. Sacrificing the high ground enticed Arena's troops, and the poorly placed line gave them an opening. Arena's champion took the advantage, his troops filing into the gap, segregating Isaria's men and acquiring a pathway to summit. Balin's men did not appear. No charge from the rear. No final rout. He had abandoned her. Isaria's heart plummeted into her stomach, and she looked for Malcius. He was there in the fray, deep in the thick of it, determined to drive the enemy into the rear forces that were not coming. She hurried to the crest of the hill and scanned the other hill to see how Iphigen's troops fared, and was shocked. His hill had been overrun, and Arena's forces had been diverted to her field. Dolinar ran up to her, breathing heavily as he leaned on his knees. He was bleeding from several gashes, and his armor was hanging from one shoulder.
Echelon Arena has broken the terms of the challenge. She was not satisfied to wait and see if you would fail. She seeks to overthrow Echelon Dishari.
I see that. Where is Balin?
He pointed toward the base of the rise along the river.
There. Echelon Arena's troops are now nearly double, and he was forced to engage much farther back. If he had not been there, though, we would already have been overrun.
Isaria had to think fast. What would Rezkin do? Something unimaginable, she was sure.
Gather the mages, she said. Move the river.
He looked at her as if she were mad.
You wish for us to do what? That is impossible.
No,
she said, pointing to the gentle slope of the ridge along the hill's elongated western flank.
The saddle there is low, and the rock beds dip away. You can see where they have already slumped. With a bit of power, you can force them to slide on their own. It will dam the river and open a passage through there. The field below will be flooded. Orina's troops will be decimated.
And some of our own, said Dolinar.
We will sound a retreat right before you act. We will save as many as we can, but if we do nothing, all of them will die.
I am an earth mage. I know this land. What you ask? I do not believe it can be done.
We cannot know until we try. And if we do not try, we will never have another chance.
Dolinar nodded and then sprinted off to gather the few mages at their disposal. Isaria gripped her sword, whispered a prayer to the Maker, and then descended into the turmoil, fighting her way toward Malcius. The grass on the slope had been ripped and churned, and the topsoil had become loose. With every precarious step, Isaria slashed and ducked. She used her body weight to send more than one enemy tumbling down the hill, and tried to catch a few of her own men, who might have shared the same fate. She finally caught up with Malcius. And without discussion, the two fell into the partnered combat they had been taught. Guarding each other's backs, they fought until those in their immediate vicinity were dead, then moved farther along the line. After what felt like years, Isaria heard a resounding crack, followed by a massive rumble. The ground shook beneath their feet, and soldiers on both sides paused in fear of what was to come. She looked for the signal, but there was no sign for retreat, so she kept fighting. Several minutes later, there was another blast, this one louder. This time the ground's trembling was accompanied by the roar of rushing water. Isaria screamed,
"Retreat! Retreat!"
She grabbed Malcius and began dragging him up the hill as they swatted away those in pursuit. The water blasted past, only paces below their position. As it tore through the hill, it took with it chunks of soil. The slope on which they sought refuge began to fall into the churning muck. With masses of earth eroding beneath them, Isaria and Malcius ran for the steeper high ground of the eastern flank. As they gripped an outcrop for support, Isaria looked over the battleground. Most, but not all, of her troops had made it to higher ground. The lowland was a swath of churning gray water, seeking its way back toward the riverbed. Across the river, on the other side of what had been the western flank of her hill, Balin and his men fought the last of their enemies on a low rise over the empty tract where the river had previously flowed. Isaria breathed heavily and motioned for Malcius to follow. They crested the hill and found the mages lying in the grass in varying states of well-being. Isaria slid down the slope that had once been slight and came to a stop next to Dolinar, who lay back staring at the sky. She looked up at the life mage, whose name she could not remember.
Good job with the horses!
The woman waved her hand in dismissal.
It was nothing compared to this,
she said with a wave toward the cliff that fell into the new path of the river. Looking down at Dolinar, Isaria said,
What is wrong with him?
The woman said,
He overextended his power. He will be ill and disoriented for some time, but he will be fine once he regains his power. If he regains his power.
This could be permanent?
The woman shrugged.
Sometimes. At least he is not dead.
Malcius said,
Death might be preferable to this.
The woman smiled faintly and stroked the braid at Dolinar's temple.
I am sure he will recover. Dolinar is strong.
You are his Matria?
With a nod, the woman said,
We are members of the Echelon's household. She will not be pleased that we fought for you.
Isaria stood and said,
You need not worry about that. Tishari is no longer Echelon. I have won the challenge. Now I must issue another.
She mounted the rise and then stalked down the hill with determination, skirting the water to the east. As she marched, those of her troops who could stand gathered in her wake. Malcius hurried beside her.
What are you doing? He said.
I must challenge Arena.
For what? We have won! We can go now!
She broke the terms of the challenge against the third Echelon, which is now me. If I do not challenge her, I will appear weak and lose standing.
What do you care? Malcius said. We can leave!
Isaria stopped to face him and pointed back to the men and woman who had followed her into combat.
They fought for nothing more than a respect for my motives and the promise of a better Echelon. Arena has proven to be without honor. If I leave the Echelon in disarray, she will claim it and place one of her ilk in the position. If I abandon these people now, they will have fought for nothing.
Isaria began walking again toward Arena's encampment on the other side of the valley.
Right now, Arena is weak. Her forces are destroyed. She cannot defend herself against a challenge.
When they arrived, Arena's servants were rushing to pack her belongings. Isaria stopped outside the Echelon's tent and called to her.
Arena Gauldron of the fourth Echelon, I am Isaria Ray of the third Echelon. You have violated the covenant of challenge against the third Echelon. On behalf of my people, I challenge you for your seat.
A blonde woman in a slinky green dress and beige sandals stepped out of the tent. She carried a folding fan that she used to cool herself as she stood nonchalantly looking at the crowd.
I am Echelon Arena Gauldron. You cannot challenge me. My arrangement was made with Echelon de Shari Brigolsi.
Isaria raised her sword toward the woman.
I have won her seat in challenge. I am now third Echelon, and I am here to hold you accountable.
Arena's eyes widened.
De Shari said nothing of a challenge for her seat. She said the challenge was for a claim on a foreigner.
Isaria grinned.
Then she lied. She tried to take my man, and I challenged her for her seat in return. That is irrelevant, though, as it has no bearing on your actions.
Arena straightened.
Her forces were split, and there was unrest in her camp. I would have been remiss not to take advantage of the situation. I do not believe you were unaware of the challenge for her seat. It was no secret. You thought to destroy us both and claim the Echelon.
A scream emanated from the tent, and a woman came running out, nearly colliding with Arena. Arena turned and screamed at her retainers.
You were supposed to keep her quiet, you idiots! She kidnapped me,
screamed Dishari.
In the middle of a challenge. It is not permitted. The challenge is void.
Isaria said,
No, Dishari. I completed the challenge. I prevailed against her forces. Both units. Whereas your champion fell.
Dishari's face paled.
Iphigen is dead?
She looked at Arena in horror.
You said nothing. You would not even permit me to mourn my consort.
Isaria said,
You plotted against me, Dishari, and Arena plotted against you. Now I will take both your echelons.
Isaria met Dishari's stricken gaze and said,
You nipped at the wolf's heels, and the wolf bit back.
Arena glanced around as if searching for something, or someone.
I need a champion,
she shouted. She looked to one of her sodden men who had been lucky enough to survive the flood. He was a hard-looking man with scars across his bare chest. He shook his head. She looked to another, and he too refused. She called out,
Whoever serves as my champion will become first consort to the Echelon.
No one stepped forward. Isaria sheathed her sword.
You have failed to produce a champion. Your seat is forfeit.
On behalf of what house do you claim the echelons?
Said the man with the scars. Isaria paused. She could not claim the echelons under House Rey, or the power would go to her aunt. She had to claim them for herself.
What is it?
Malcius whispered.
They wish to know the name of my house.
He stared at her for a moment, and then said,
Palace.
She glanced at him to see if he was serious. He motioned for her to proceed. She looked at him again, uncertainly, then turned back to the crowd.
I claim the third and fourth echelons under House Bellis.
Chapter 18. Tam and Uthe, together, followed the rest of the prisoners through the passage. It was the first daylight he had seen in over a week after being held in the dark cell of the cave near the docks. A few times a day, a guard would walk past their cell carrying a torch. Twice each day, someone opened their cells to toss in food, which was already rancid half the time, and a couple of buckets of putrid water. That was all the light they had seen. In those brief moments, Tam had estimated about 30 people shared his cell. Sometimes he heard them whispering or crying in the dark, but most kept quiet. Sometimes they stood, and sometimes they sat, but they never moved about. Their bodies had been forsaken to the darkness, their minds trapped within the confines of their imaginations. Tam had wondered if he would ever see the sun again. He squeezed his eyes shut against the brightness. The sharp pain behind his eyeballs nearly dropped him to his knees. He stumbled on the sandy path, but Uthe pulled him to his feet, not out of kindness or concern. The slavers had few rules. One, do as they say, or you will be tortured or killed. And two, whatever happens to your partner happens to you. Uthe was looking out for his own neck. Tam flinched when a rock collided with his temple. He blinked up toward the top of the passage. The walls were made of posts as thick as his arm, tied together with rope and covered in canvas. A walkway had been constructed along the top on the other side, and guards paced back and forth watching their progress. Filthy children laughed as they threw rocks and dirt clods at the prisoners from above. Tam searched the figures around him as he dragged his feet through the sand. He recognized many of the prisoners as those who had been trapped in the ship's hull with him, but there were also others. It was not surprising that many faces were missing. A handful had died before they had even reached port. Several others had died in the cell. He had been forced to sleep next to a corpse for 2 days before the guards finally came for the bodies. What had made it all the worse was that he had spoken to the woman. He had assured her that they would find a way out of the mess. He supposed she had found a way out. A sharp pain shot through his head, and stars swam before his eyes. Sometimes he envied the dead.
What is wrong with you?
Whispered Uthe.
I have a hole in my mind,
he mumbled.
You mean in your head? It's called your nose, and you're bleeding from it.
Tam wiped his nose. Considering the amount of pain, he was surprised there was so little blood. He closed his eyes for a moment, allowing Uthe to pull him along, and concentrated on his breathing. He blocked out the sounds as best he could, and the pain began to subside. It struck again when he opened his eyes, but it was not as strong as before. As they neared what he thought to be the end of the passage, they were suddenly assailed with streams of cold water. Guards and a few water mages stood atop the wall, tossing buckets or casting streams over their heads. Tam shivered, but was grateful to get rid of the filth. The water stopped too quickly, though, and he realized that he was still covered in filth, only now it was wet filth. They marched forward again, the passage opening into an appalling market. Instead of carts and stalls filled with goods and food, row upon row of cages filled with men, women, and even children lined the paths. Some of the cages contained dogs or more exotic species. Merchants, traders, and other wealthy sorts strolled down the rows, taking notes and asking questions of the slavers. As Tam and Uthe were shoved into a cage, he realized that these people saw no difference between the prisoners and the animals.
What happens now?
He said.
Now they will wait for someone to buy us, said Ute. If we are lucky, we'll go to a plantation. We don't want to end up on a ship or in the mines.
I don't intend to be a slave for the rest of my life.
We need to escape. How do you propose we do that?
I can pick the lock on the cage. We can open some of the other cages to create a distraction. If we make it to the docks, we can stow away on a merchant ship or steal some clothes and pretend to be sailors.
And what about these?
Said Ute as he lifted the chain attached to their necks. Tam eyed Ute's collar.
Do you think they're enchanted?
Ute narrowed his eyes as he looked at Tam's.
Don't see any runes. They've got a place for a key.
I might be able to pick those too, said Tam. I'll need a couple of pins. Something thin and sharp but strong.
They searched the cage for anything of use. The sides and top had bars made of thick iron. The ground was sandy, but more bars lay only a few inches deep. Tam was glad a roof lay over the bars, even if it was made of old, rotting boards. One of the slavers walked up and smacked a cane against the bars, eliciting a jarring ring that smacked Tam right behind his eyes. The slaver said,
Gundu da bundunana! Nihishet kwavugarana!
Tam looked to Ute, who shrugged and said,
I don't speak Verili.
The slaver said in Gendishin,
You need not bother. You cannot escape.
My people will come, said Tam.
You have made a mistake in taking us.
The man laughed, sun-darkened skin stretching tight over his sharp cheekbones.
You Gendishin are all the same. You think too highly of yourselves.
You are no one now.
Your people, if you have any, will not find you. If they come looking, maybe we will throw them in a cage, too!
He cackled at his own joke as he walked away. As Tam and Ute waited out the day, two more pairs of prisoners joined them. One of them was a young woman who looked terrified. The man she was chained to pulled her into his lap as he lounged against the bars. He ran his fingers over the bare flesh of her arms and neck. Her dress had been ripped down the front, and she held it together where it had been hastily tied in knots. The man looked up at Tam and grinned.
At least they gave me a consolation prize.
Tam looked at the woman.
Do you know this man?
She blinked at him, then cried,
I don't know what you're saying. I don't know what anyone is saying.
You're a Cheyenne?
He said. The woman's face lit, and she smiled for the first time. She struggled to climb out of the man's lap to get closer to Tam.
Please, tell me what's happening. Where are we?
My name is Tamarin Blackwater. I'm also from Ashai. What is your name?
Melena.
Melena? I believe we're on the Isle of Sand. They intend to sell us for slaves.
She shook her head vigorously.
But I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not a criminal. I was visiting my sister and her husband in Jeria, and these men came in and took us. I don't know what happened to her. Why did they take us?
Are you aware that King Cadian has started a war?
With Jeria?
With everyone. The Shines are no longer safe in the other kingdoms. We are refugees.
They must let us go home,
she cried.
He shook his head. It is not safe there either. Cadian has declared war on his own people. He has arrested or killed over half the noble families and their retainers. Most of the commoners have been drafted into the army or forced to work in support of the army.
Seeing her horrified expression, he said,
But there is hope. The true king of Ashai has established a new kingdom, the kingdom of Kyle. All refugees are welcome there.
One of the other prisoners laughed. With a Chenarian accent, he said,
The true king! The kingdom of Kyle? Your myths. No such place exists. You look for saviors where there are none.
Tam scowled at the man.
It does exist. I've been there and I serve the true king. He will come for me.
The man laughed again.
You, this true king, the savior of Ishai, will come for you.
He looked at Melena.
Do not listen to him. He has lost his mind.
Tam pointed to his head.
I haven't lost my mind, he hissed. There's a hole in it. They put it there while I was on Kyle.
The others shared a knowing look. Melena's face fell and tears welled in her eyes. Tam leaned forward to grasp her hand.
I'm not mad, and I'm not lying. When we escape, I will take you there.
Her smile did not reach her eyes.
Thank you, she said as she patted his hand. That is kind.
By her patronizing tone, Tam knew she did not believe him. That night, the slavers did not vacate the market. They gathered around fire pits at the intersections, eating and laughing. The prisoners had not been fed that night, and Tam's stomach burned. Worse than the hunger was the thirst. After weeks in the ship's hold and another in the dark cave, he knew that if they did not escape soon, he would be too weak to try.
They do it on purpose, you know.
Tam rolled his head toward Uthe.
Do what? Keep us hungry and thirsty? Keep us weak?
Tam wondered if he had spoken his thoughts aloud.
So that we can't escape?
Nah. They've got that under control,
Uthe said with a lift of his arm and the jingle of the chain.
They think if we're miserable, we'll be thankful to our new masters when they feed us. We're less likely to give them trouble. You can't be grateful for what you have unless you know how much worse it could be.
Tam said,
Maybe that works for some, but I remember how much better it can be.
Then you've lived a blessed life. I guess being a king's man will do it for you. Yeah, I heard your nonsense. I don't speak Ashayan, but I understand a bit of the trade language. I got the gist of it. I don't care if you're mad, so long as you don't get me killed.
I'm not mad, said Tam. I need to find some healers. The mages cast a spell to put a hole in my mind so that I can learn things faster. If they don't close it soon, I'll die. It's probably too late as it is, but I'm not ready to give up.
That'd be a neat trick, having things spill into your mind. I don't believe you, but even if I did, it wouldn't matter. You're not going to find any healers. From what I hear, Verrill doesn't have many. Only a few for the king and court. No way there's any around here.
Tam growled in frustration.
You don't believe me? A few months ago, I didn't speak a word of Gendishin.
Uthe shrugged.
Maybe you did. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you're a fast learner. Why don't you do us a favor and learn Verrilli? That'd be somewhat useful.
That's the problem. I don't choose what I learn. It all just flows in. All of it. I didn't notice at first. The hole was smaller, maybe. Lately, I can feel it. Everything goes in, but it's a mess. I can't sort through it. It's tearing my mind apart. It's why I get these headaches and nosebleeds.
I think you've got a tumor. You know what that is? My cousin's friend's sister's mother had one. She went to a healer. He said it's where a lump grows in your brain that doesn't belong there. It makes you think all kinds of crazy things. Gives you headaches and nosebleeds, too.
It's not a tumor, said Tam.
Uthe shrugged again.
Of course you would say that. You have a tumor.
The next morning they were marched through the passage again. After visiting an open pit where they could relieve themselves without privacy, they were lined up for inspection. Men and women peered into their mouths and ears and poked them as nearly every inch of their bodies was examined. Tam was glad they had at least been allowed to wear clothes, even if his boots had been taken. The prisoners who resisted were beaten, and those that did not live up to the slavers' standards were taken away, their partners reassigned. After being thoroughly humiliated, the prisoners were returned to their cages. The others who had shared the space with Uthe and Tam were still there, but an additional set of strangers had been added to the cage that was smaller than a horse stall. After a while, a commotion erupted farther down the lane. The hoots and hollers moved closer, and Tam peered through the bars to find a source. A couple of men were walking alongside a cart pulled by a donkey. The cart was piled high with slop. Tam's stomach grumbled, and where before he would never have considered eating what looked like a tavern's refuse, he was now elated to see such a bounty. The cart stopped in front of their cage, and one of the men used a bucket to scoop out some of the slop. Then he threw it into their cages through the bars, not even bothering to open the door. The prisoners descended on the rubbish like rabid animals. Tam included. He briefly worried that Melena would go hungry until one man tried to claim her score and she bit him. Tam sat cross-legged with his stash in his lap, shoving chunks of old cabbage and hard biscuits into his mouth. Uthe said,
"Who's the woman?"
Tam gave him a questioning glance. With a nod, Uthe said,
"That's not something a man buys for himself."
Tam glanced at his wrist. It seemed like a terribly long time ago, but he had once sat outside a horse stall on a ship, talking with a beautiful, sweet girl named Nettie. She had woven the small bracelet from horsehair and hay. As he looked at it now, he found a few golden strands that must have belonged to her. He dabbed the crumbs that had fallen on his pants, refusing to lose the tiniest morsel. He said,
"It's a trivial thing, a minor token, a gift from someone I thought to court. Then I realized she was far above my station, and it would never happen."
"So you fancy the real lady? Can't imagine one giving out bracelets made of grass and hair. Who was she, really? The weaver's daughter?"
Tam scowled at him.
"You're right. She isn't a lady. She's a princess."
Uthe laughed.
"Of course, Kingsman. You would think to marry a princess. Mayhap your princess will sew you a new suit and clean your boots, too. I almost envy your tumor. You may be crazy, but you dream a pleasant life."
Tam picked up a small, mushy potato covered in sprouts. He took a large bite and was thankful for the moisture, despite the bitter taste. Uthe leaned over and whispered,
"You need to take more."
Tam's chewing was made more difficult by the dryness in his mouth, but he finally swallowed and said,
"I took my share. Everyone needs to eat."
Uthe nodded toward the newcomers.
"The skinny ones won't make it anyway."
He looked back at Tam.
"Your eyes are innocent, and you smile too much, but your body is fit. You might be useful in a fight. You need to stay strong."
"I've seen my share of trouble," said Tam. "Had some run-ins with bandits, took out a few slavers when they came for me, and I was in Scutton at the time of the attack on the King's Tournament."
"I might have caused a stir when they took me as well," said Uthe.
He nodded toward the others.
"I've noticed something about the pairings. It doesn't seem random. The woman and that man, they're both the good-looking sort, a bit soft. Nobles like that kind of thing around their estates."
He nodded to the next pair.
"Those two are scrawny. Not sure what good they'll be. Those two over there are strong."
He looked back to Tam.
"I think they put us together for a reason, and I doubt it'll be a plush plantation for you and me. We'll need to keep each other's backs where we're going."
"Where's that?"
Uthe shrugged.
"Don't know, but it's sure to be full of men like us."
One of the larger men, a curly-haired fellow with a flat nose, said,
"Hey, what are you two going on about over there?"
He looked to the others for support.
"They're talking about us. They're plotting something."
Melena's partner pulled her into his lap.
"Come here, darling. Best keep you out of their way."
Melena pushed and kicked at him, but he held strong as his hands started to roam her body. Tam said,
"Stop it! You leave her alone, or—"
"Or what?"
The man lifted his chin toward where the slavers lurked.
"Remember, what happens to me happens to her.
Only if they think you've been causing trouble. If you die of natural causes, she'll get a new partner."
"Natural causes?"
The man laughed.
"You think to starve me to death? Maybe wait till I die of old age." "Ain't none of us gonna die of old age,"
muttered Uthe.
"All the more reason to have a little fun before I go," said the man.
Tam stood and looked back at Uthe, who grumbled but followed as he stepped across the cage. The others stood as well in anticipation of a fight. The woman scrambled out of the man's lap and backed away the length of her restraint. Tam faced her partner with determination. The big man who had voiced his discontent moments before stepped up to Tam's left. Tam elbowed him in the stomach and then backhanded his temple, sending the man crashing into his partner and causing the two of them to fall into the other men. Ducking a swing from the woman's partner, Tam thrust his open palm in the V below the man's sternum, just as Rezkin had taught him. He felt the small bone break away, and he knew he had used enough force for it to have punctured something vital. As the man doubled over, Tam backed to his side of the cage. He gave the other men a warning glare, and Milena's partner slid to the floor, holding his abdomen. Tam retook his seat, and Uthe followed. The gasping man looked at him with fury in his eyes and said,
"When I catch my breath, I'm gonna make you pay for that. Then, I'm gonna make her pay for it, too."
Tam met the man's dark gaze.
"You'll be lucky to see the morning. Either way, you'll not be in the mood to bother her."
Uthe looked over at him and grinned.
"You will do well in a fight, so long as you don't kick the lion."
A bubble of laughter broke through Tam's misery as he thought of how Rezkin might respond. He said,
"I am the lion."
Tam awoke the next morning to a squeal. Milena said,
"He's dead! By the Maker, he's dead!"
She yanked the chain around her neck as if it might fall away with the effort.
"Get it off me!"
She gripped the bars and screamed for the slavers.
"Help me! Get him away! He's dead!"
Her frantic gaze darted around the cage.
"I can't be chained to a corpse!"
Uthe nudged Tam and said,
"You killed him with one strike. I was standing right next to you, and I barely saw it."
Tam was also a little surprised. Rezkin had told him the technique could kill a man, but he had not truly expected it to work. His muscles began to tighten with anxiety as Milena's cries finally caught the attention of their captors.
"What is it? I will make you suffer if you waste my time," said the nearest slaver.
He was a gap-toothed man with long, stringy hair gathered into multiple messy braids. Shells and other small trinkets were tied into the locks as well as his plaited beard.
"Please,"
said Milena.
"My partner is dead. Please take him away."
The man looked at her, but he did not appear to understand her words. Tam said,
"That man is dead. He should be removed before the rest of us succumb to his illness."
Another man approached, this one bearing a large stick Tam had seen him use to beat people, sometimes even other slavers.
"What is happening here? What trouble have you caused now, Fiero?"
Fiero pointed into the cage.
"I've done nothing, Ipan. One of the prisoners is dead."
Ipan opened the cage and dragged the dead man out, pulling Milena with him. He looked the corpse over and said,
"No blood. No marks. Did you give them water?"
"Same as the others,"
Fiero said, waving to the other cages. Ipan pointed to Milena.
"What is she doing in there?"
"We're holding the two of them for Lady Esquiva."
"I know that, you idiot. Why is she with the men? Lady Esquiva will not want her if she arrives with child."
He pointed to the dead man.
"I'm holding you responsible for this, Fiero. His price will come out of your pay. You lose nearly as many as you sell. If I didn't keep constant watch over you, we would have none to sell at all."
"That's not true, Ipan. It's not my fault. These are Barbarous' slaves."
"Gah, you blame Barbarous. If you were one of the other men, I would beat you senseless."
"But you know his are always half dead when they arrive."
"I can't argue with that, but you should know that means they need extra care when they get here. How did I get stuck with an idiot for a son? Put her with the women and get rid of this one."
As Ipan walked away, he shouted,
"And give them extra food and water!"
Uthe leaned over.
"What did they say?"
Tam glanced at him in annoyance.
"Aren't you listening? They think he died of thirst. They're going to move her with the women and give us more food and water."
Uthe's gaze followed Fiero as he dragged away the body. He said,
"How did you know what they were saying?"
"I'm not deaf,"
Tam said.
"That's obvious, but they were speaking Verili, and so were you."
Then Uthe smacked Tam on the back.
"You've done us a service. Many thanks, friend."
Tam was uncomfortable being thanked for killing a man, at least not only because they would receive extra food and water. He had done it for Milena, and she had been separated from them. He supposed it was better for her to join the women. He felt a drop of moisture on his hand and looked down. His nose was bleeding again. Then, it was as if a light burst before his eyes. The port city of Havoth was in an uproar as Rezkin rode through the streets. He was surprised by the size of the fanfare, considering the event had only been planned and implemented